This is a Triple J podcast.
Hello, welcome to another episode of Science with Dr. Carl in your podcast feed. And I wanted to read you some of the texts that came through this week that made their way into the episode as questions. Now, this is verbatim. I have a genuine pine cone inquiry for Dr. Carl. I love that wording, genuine pine cone inquiry. Naturally, we said we need to find out more about this. Bree in Newcastle, how the hell does a plane just take off the ground? I think we've all wondered that. And Gaynor texted in saying, I would love to know how far do fish see. I have a fish pond inside and I swear they watch me when I'm inside. What is going on with these fish? You're going to find out all of this and more in this week's episode. Let's jump in. Dr. Carl is across from me right now. Dr. Carl, how are you?
Oh, ever so peachy keen.
Yeah, what's been happening? What's one thing you learnt this week?
Ozempic. So that drug came to us from the Gila monster nearly 50 years ago. In 1980, we first started working on it, and it took nearly 45 years for it to come to market. And we've discovered that it has all sorts of other effects.
So hang on, the Gila monster.
The Gila monster.
So I've heard of a Gila monster on a King Gizzard and the Lizard Wizard song.
What?
They have a song called Gila, Gila Monster. And
wow. It's a creature that is a short, fat reptile, maybe half a metre long, moves slowly, spends 95% of the time underground.
That checks
hardly
out.
Eats any food.
Oh.
And that ties in with the ability of it to make a chemical in its venom that can, in humans, ultimately end up leading to treating diabetes and insulin. This little creature is bottom right-hand corner of the USA and just in Mexico on the other side. And it comes out with a chemical called a peptide, which is about 30 or 40 amino acids long. And I've been getting a little bit worried about people cheerfully saying, oh, I'm taking peptides. And so now my boob muscles are terrific and my arm muscles are terrific and I'm look maxing. And if you're looking even at just 10 peptides and 10 amino acids in a row. So a peptide is made of amino acids. And if you're just looking at a short one with only 10 amino acids, the number of different possible combinations are greater than the number of stars in the Milky Way galaxy.
Whoa.
And the stuff that they're manufacturing is not made to medical standards. And so it can do this, and sometimes it can do that, and people have died from taking the peptides. Peptide covers an infinity of sins. And so that's our public service announcement for today. Be careful.
Okay.
Be careful out there, folks. Can we say it in a sort of meaningful way? Do we sound like somebody letting the cops go out on a night shift?
How would you say it?
Be careful out there, man. I don't know.
What led you to this discovery? What were you reading something or?
Yeah, I was reading an article in the New York Times about it, and then that just started me on the fact I didn't know what Ozempic was.
Mm.
I didn't know that we made our own natural Ozempic, and surprisingly, in our brain and in the far end of the gut, and it has effects on the gut but also on the brain, but it's got a half-life of 2 minutes.
Mm.
And the good thing about the Gila monster, the venom that it makes, the peptide, it's roughly half the amino acids the same as what we make, but instead of lasting for 2 minutes, it lasts for hours. And
right.
We can even trigger it to last for days. And you're at the situation now where obesity is relatively major in the USA. On the other hand, the side effects of the Ozempic can be very high and people go off it, even though they lose weight, because they've got vomiting, nausea, all sorts of messy stuff.
Yeah, there's still a lot we don't know. If you've got a question, 0439 757 555 on that. Dr. Carl, it's just you and me today. You know, we've had
a few
really great guests recently. We had Peter Lebedev talking about AI. We had Hannah Gould last week talking about the science of death and dying.
Oh.
So, hey, if you want to check in on those episodes.
You tell me another thing about Roombas. You know those automatic little vacuum cleaners that go around?
Oh, yeah.
Right. So it wasn't that brand, but it was another one. It was a very popular one. And so a mate of his had been had one of these little vacuum cleaners that goes around, and he thought, gee, the software sucks. I'm going to make better software. So he did, and accidentally ended up using the same program that took him to the mothership of the company. And from the mothership of the company, he could see in every country of the world that people were using it, pictures of their living room.
No.
So as the vacuum cleaner goes around, it's taking pictures of everything, And he could see all those pictures from different people's houses across the world.
Oh, my gosh.
Mate, we are the most surveilled society.
I know.
Your phone is alive all the time, recording everything and reporting it to the mothership somewhere. Is there anything called privacy left?
I don't think so. We get into all of that with Peter Lebedev. You can listen back to those episodes via the Science with Dr. Carl podcast. Let's get into some new questions. Brock in Ballarat, what do you want to know? You're kicking us off.
So I was just curious why, when we're nervous, it makes our stomach feel sick and like going in like circles.
Mm. It's tied with our good friend, the sympathetic nervous system. As I've said before, it deals with fight, fright, flight, making love and fawning. And it activates a specific bunch of metabolic and muscular and hormonal activities to help you get out of a fight. So the blood supply to your skin is decreased, so you don't bleed too much. The blood supply to your muscles is increased, so you're sitting there shivering because you want to do something, but you haven't got a target yet. And the blood supply to your gut is decreased, so you're ready to vomit. And that nauseous thing is related to that. So if there's a really big fight going on between a couple of animals, you'll see one of them will just stop and then casually go, and just vomit out everything. Mm. Okay, I'm a bit lighter and I'm ready to fight you. And so that's part of what's happening in humans. We get that sort of nausea thing. And it can happen to an unnecessary degree in some people where if you're just thinking, I've got to catch the bus. Oh, my God, I'm getting nervous in case I'm late. So there's a whole bunch of practical things you can do, like the 4-3-2-1 thing, like the grounding. All right, now I'm worried about the bus, but I can. There are five things that I can see, and I can feel four things, like I can feel my socks and the wind's blowing on my face, and I can hear the sound of the birds, and you ground yourself in the reality and you move yourself away from that. And then also just actually walking and getting physical helps, and then there's all that boring stuff about being healthy and well-rested and sleep, all that sort of
box
stuff.
Box breathing,
does that
all
kind
of that.
Help a bit? Is that what you're interested in?
Yeah, that's cool. Thank you.
Thanks, Brock.
Thank you, Dr. Brock.
Tyson in Mianjin, Brisbane. Dr. Tyson, you got a question about viruses.
Yes. Hello, Dr. Giller Monster. Hope you're well. Big fan.
Love it.
The question I have is, when you come down with a virus, at what kind of point are you the most contagious? Like, is it at the start, the middle, the end?
Well, you can kind of guess by thinking of the virus as kind of a living creature and it wants to have as many babies as possible. So it's to the benefit of the virus that it spreads itself around before you're fully contagious. So normally they'll do it 1 or 2 days beforehand. Now, I just have to look this up, but I think that COVID was most infectious, I think, 2 or 3 days before, influenza about 3 or 4 days before. There are some diseases that will still be very, very infectious after you have the symptoms, but they're in a minority. Mm. But in general, before you've got it, you're spreading it. I'm sorry. Isn't that unfair? But it's good for the virus, though. Mm. And by the way, if you got all of the viruses in the ocean and put them end to end, remarkably frustrating task, but I think it could be done, it would reach the distance between here and the nearest galaxy, which is the Andromeda Galaxy, 2 million light years away, it would reach between here and that galaxy 10 times.
Ah! We are crawling with viruses.
Yeah, they're just part of the rich panoply of life.
Thanks, Tyson.
Thank you, Dr. Tyson.
Thank you.
And thanks, we've Carlos. Got Gaynor in Palm Cove, Queensland. Gaynor, what's going on with your fish?
G'day, Lucy. I feel like I'm being stalked by my fish.
What? Your fish? F-I-S-H? The things in the tank?
Yeah. I've got a little fish pond inside the house.
Ah.
And if I try sneaking into the kitchen and make myself a coffee, they all do little zoomies and jump out of the water as if to go, we can see you, it's time to be fed now. And they are the most craziest little creatures. But, I'm just wondering, how far can fish actually see, Dr. Carl?
Mm.
Through the air, you and I can see a vast distance, and fish can, uh-huh. depending on how well focused their eyes are. You begin to have trouble seeing through air when you're looking through, say, maybe 50 or 100 kilometres of it, like the astronauts in the International Space Station 400 kilometres up. In water, you can normally see maybe 20, 30 metres and then it gets too opaque for both us and fish. There are some fish that hover around on a surface, and they have got a split eye where they've got one set of optics for above the water and one below. What sort of fish are they? Are they goldfish? Or
no, just your gorgeous little guppies with the bright little tails and... Yeah, because the cutest little characters. Like you stick your fingers in, and they'll chew on the end of your fingers.
Oh my gosh!
Hey, don't people actually pay money to have fish eat the dead skin off their feet or something?
Yeah, you got
to
be so careful.
Yeah, yeah. No, that creeps me out. Yeah, okay, fair enough. Yeah.
So, how far are you from the fish when they begin to react to your physical, the visual presence?
Usually about 3 meters.
Okay, right.
And occasionally I'll try sneaking up on them and like try to scare them. Well, tippy toes so they don't get the vibration.
And this is a good scientific experience. And how often do you feed them?
Every morning, same time.
So do they do this mainly in the morning, or will they still do it in the afternoon, trying to trick you into forgetting that you've already fed them that day?
Yeah, they try that one too, love. Yeah, I'll get home from work and they're doing zoomies and trying to jump out the tank. And I'm like, yeah, okay, kids, I'm coming. Yeah.
Okay, so they will not see you as clearly through the air as underwater, but they'll definitely be seeing you, and they've almost certainly remembered your presence. It's a myth that goldfish have a memory of only 3 minutes. The experiment was done where they got some goldfish in a tank, and then they ran a net through the tank, confining them to one end, and the goldfish are going, freak, 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 I'm being squashed. And there was a little hole in the middle of the net, and eventually the goldfish would find, oh, there's a hole, I got out, hooray, hooray. And then roughly one half of the lifetime of a goldfish later, I think it was 12 or 18 months later, they did the same experiment, and this time the goldfish said, oh, that net again, okay, and went straight for the middle. So they can remember stuff. It is a myth that they can't remember stuff, and they love you to pieces. You're a very lucky person to have extra love from goldfish. And, sorry, what are they, guppies?
Guppyfish.
Guppies.
Yeah, guppies, and then the kookaburras come in every afternoon on the pool fence. So I've got a menagerie, to be honest. I love it.
You're like Snow White.
Wow.
Another reason why I'm still single.
Gaynor, thank you so much for your question.
Thanks, Lucy. Thanks, Carl. Bye, love.
Right, 0439 757 555 if you want to send through your question for Dr. Carl. Someone saying, Carl saying looks maxing was not on my bingo card this year. Carl, you're across it. Looks maxing.
Hang on, it was, and you got these people. I've been looking at some of them and they say things like, hey, look at me, aren't I fantastic? Oh, by the way, here's somebody who was mean to me, so I deliberately ran them over, and here's a video of me running them over.
We could talk about this.
That is very naughty.
It's crazy.
It's very suboptimal behaviour.
Alec in Nam, Melbourne, what do you want to know this morning?
I would like to know, so if the human body works off electrical impulses and charge and all that, mainly from the brain, what in the brain actually like holds that charge? Where is that charge actually coming from? Because energy isn't free, so where's the brain getting it from?
Glucose. Question. So in the case of, sorry, Adam or Alec?
Alec.
So Alec, Dr. Alec, sorry, I left out the doctor.
All good.
In the case of you as an adult, your brain weighs 2% of your body weight, but it uses 20% of the glucose. So you eat food and it goes in two different pathways. One is to provide you with energy, mostly glucose, and the other one is for building blocks. Sometimes they can be proteins, sometimes fats, sometimes essential tiny things like vitamins. So your brain is using 20% of all your glucose, just a little diversion here. In a four-year-old kid, it's 50%. So you've got a four-year-old kid sitting there doing nothing. At rest, their brain is using 50% of all their glucose. Then you've got roughly 80-something billion nerves in your brain. Now, imagine the nerve like a copper wire. In a copper wire, you have the information transferred from copper atom to copper atom to copper atom along the electrons, but also in a wave through the air around it, traveling at the speed of light. And you can look this up on Veritasium. They've done a really good video, and Peter Lebedev was involved with that. But then in the human nerve, it's different. Imagine it's a pipe, like a garden hose, and it resists electrical charges going across it. And there's all sorts of electrical charges in the body. There's sodium ions, potassium ions, calcium ions, chloride ions. And suddenly, the like a ring of this garden hose loses its ability to stop charge going across. and charge goes across. And then it restores itself immediately, and this wave of depolarization runs along the nerve, quickly in big nerves, slower in small nerves, and reaches the other end. At the other end of the nerve, it then causes little chemicals to be released from what they call the synaptic bulb, and these chemicals travel a very tiny distance, like 20 billionths of a meter, and they fit into little receptors on the next nerve, and then that sets off another action potential. So you've got this weird thing going between electricity and chemicals, and electricity and chemicals, and your brain cells are continually being rebuilt on the run, so that after, say, a few months, practically all of the atoms have gone and been replaced by other atoms in the same patterns, in the same places. And that raises the question of, are you you? The total amount of current is roughly that a house can draw, about 60 amperes, but instead of being at 240 volts, it's normally at around 80,000th of a volt. So that's a bit of background. Now, where do you want to go from that, Dr. Alec?
Oh, well, I can't believe we take it so for granted. Like, even simply just breathing and all this process is going on in the background, it's my mind is blown.
Well, we are this giant hydraulics metabolic mix, but on the outside we've just got boring old skin. It's amazing that we, you know, like, we're just so dynamic underneath. All I can do is recommend go to Wikipedia and have a go happy hunting, look up the brain, take it from there, man.
Go crazy, Alec.
Absolutely. Peachy King, guys. Thank you,
Dr. Alec. Yay. Let's go to Nui now. We've got Bree. Dr. Bree, a question I think we've all wondered. What do you want to know?
Hi, Lucy and Dr. Carl. I wanted to know, I went on one of my first plane rides the other day because I played bass in the grass with one of my band's Maple's Pet Dinosaur.
You say that all that sentence again? You played?
I played a festival called Bass in the Grass on the weekend.
Oh, you're a musician.
And because I live in Newcastle, I had to fly to Darwin, and, you know, the last planes I've been on, I was really young, so I don't really remember anything, but this plane ride, because I'm a bit older now, I was able to be present, and I was just really confused how you're just on the runway and you're going really slow, and then all of a sudden you're just absolutely gunning it, and then you just go up into the air. And I was scared because we got into the air, and then all of a sudden the plane sounded like my car when it nearly blows up. And then it was all good after that, but I was just really confused. Yeah.
It is tricky. I was traveling back from Melbourne yesterday next to a pilot, and he showed me a picture of me giving him a prize when he was 10 years old at his local school. And now he's flying around on aeroplanes, and he was just deadheading from one city to another. Deadheading means that they're just doing a transit.
Wow.
And flying the plane. So I'll give you the first explanation, which is wrong. So just imagine that you're traveling in a car, and this is illegal. You're not allowed to put your hand outside the window, but just imagine in a safe, controlled environment, you put your hand out of the window and you're traveling at speed and your hand is parallel to the ground. Have you got that sort of mental image, Dr. Bree?
Yeah.
Okay. So your hand is not tending to go up or down, and it's just parallel to the ground. If you lift your fingertips upwards, the air starts to hit the bottom of your hand and your hand begins to rise. It gets lifted up suddenly, more so if you're traveling faster. And that's the first version of why you fly. It's not quite right. In fact, it's kind of wrong, but there's a fair bit of truth in it. The second version is that the air splits as it goes over the wing. The wing is curved. It travels faster over the top of the wing, and then it has less pressure. So moving air has less pressure, and you can prove this by next time you're drinking in a cafe or something, make sure you're drinking, you've got a transparent straw, and then blow over the top of the straw, and the liquid level will rise in the straw. So moving air has lower pressure, and you can prove that by blowing over the top of a straw that's transparent, you know, like you're having a milkshake or something. You can even get a better effect if you blow through a straw at the top of the straw, and then you get a really concentrated air blast. And that's called the Bernoulli effect, and that's not quite right, because there are planes that have got dead flat wings, top and bottom, like the Pitts Specials, which are aerodynamic planes, and they fly perfectly fine with a dead flat wing. Then the third one is called the Kutta-Junkowski effect, and that's part of the reason that's also wrong. So the best thing is to go to my podcast, Shirtloads of Science, and I interview an aeronautical engineer who has been teaching aeronautics for the last 30, 40 years, and he realised that everything is wrong, and he came up with a better explanation. But that gets you started. So the first one is that the wing is slightly tilted up, and so when you're travelling in a plane at altitude, I think the nose is up by about 1 or 2 degrees compared to the tail, and that's providing most of the lift. And by the way, that noise you heard, mate, I'm just astonished. You got this 100-ton, 200-ton plane, and you accelerate uphill. You're going uphill, and you go from 200 kilometres an hour up to just under 1,000, and you're going uphill, and you're accelerating. And you're going, man, the power of those engines is astonishing. Okay, so I've given you a bit of homework, Bree. Is that okay?
Yep, that was all really cool.
Okay. You copy all that, Bree? Yeah,
so go to Shirtloads of Science, and we do a podcast about how planes fly, and it blew my mind.
Hey, Bree, how was Base in the Grass?
It was awesome. I got to meet G Flip and Moore Ratton, all my favourite artists backstage. So it was really the dream.
So good. Hey Bree, let's play one of your tracks right now from Maple's Pet Dinosaur. Should we play out chorus?
Hang on. Maple's
Pet Dinosaur.
Maple is the liquid that comes out of a maple tree, but it's also
Maple's Pet Dinosaur.
Pet and dinosaur, the animal that died out 65 million years ago, apart from the birds.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, it took me a while to get there, but I'm there.
Bree, thank you so much for calling in.
Thank you, Dr. Bree. We love
your
work.
Thank you.
And I might even see you up in Newey this weekend. I'm heading up there.
Oh, yeah, you're going to Newey, aren't you?
Going to Newey, mate.
Bree, you've got a question about, I guess, the work that you've been doing and protecting your hearing. Tell us what you do and what your method's been.
Yeah, no worries. G'day, doctors. I do a bit of work using power tools, and I want to listen to music while I'm doing work. So I use good quality over-ear noise-cancelling headphones, which seems to do a good job of providing tunes and protecting my hearing. But I've seen some things online recently claiming that it doesn't actually protect your hearing. So I'm just wondering if you can clarify that for me, Dr. Carl, and how noise-cancelling tech kind of works.
Mm. Ah, now, Reese, what sort of power tools? Angle grinders or percussive?
Grinders, circular saws, multi-tools, you know, just general hand tools, drop saw.
Mate, just a little aside before we get into it, the 3-inch angle grinder or the 9-inch?
The smaller one. Oh. I thought it was 4.5.
Those 9-inch ones, I've got one and it scares the heck out of me every time I use it because when I was in casualty once, a guy came in, it had been at a building site and a 9-inch blade had disintegrated into a wedge, like a skinny wedge you get from a pie at Christmas, and the pointy end first had gone through a wall and into his leg.
Wow.
Moving right along. So these things are very... yes and no. So if you go online and start reading up about not noise-cancelling headphones, just protective headphones, you'll find that they're rated in terms of dB. How many... By the way, we humans, background noise is about 30 dB. 80 dB is about as loud as you want to get before you get permanent hearing damage. 120 will damage you instantly, and that's like a jet engine taking off. And you'll find that these headphones, because I went and bought some from my brother-in-law because he's sort of gearing him up to learn how to use tools, they range from about 30 to 40 to maybe even 45 dB, but that varies across the range. So these are the headphones that are designed specifically to protect you from industrial noise. What you've got are domestic headphones, which are designed to cut the noise down in a bit in the background, but also to give you sound. And what you really want is a very specialty product, one that has the very high protection of the very best noise reduction from the outside world, plus is able to play music, plus it does the noise cancelling. The way the noise cancelling works, think about a series of waves in the ocean. They go up, down, up, down. You got a hill, a valley, a hill, a valley, a hill, a valley. And in the noise reduction headphones is or are a bunch of microphones. And they pick up the incoming noise. It used to be just one microphone. Now there's a whole lot. And they actually manufacture an upside-down copy of that noise. So where there's a hill coming about to land on your eardrum, they broadcast a valley. And when there's a valley, they broadcast a hill. And so you just end up with a flat plain. So the noise reduction headphones can be very effective. I bought them when they first came out, and I was astonished at how good they are. And I've stuck with them for years, and I just tried a new set recently. The technology is just amazing. I think really what you need, and I think this might be a niche in the market, headphones for people working with power tools.
Mm.
And so you use the noise reduction technology, but the over-ear passive protection is extra, extra good.
I think I've seen people wear maybe their AirPods and then have the noise reducing.
Oh, so over the top.
Yeah, over the
top.
That
would work. However, there is one argument against that, and it's the two magic words, situational awareness.
Mm.
So every time I do an advanced driving course, they do the thing of putting the hand over the mirror. What's behind you? And so you've got to have the situational awareness of knowing in a car what's in front of you, behind you, so you're ready to react instantly. And in the same way, there might be a little noise in the background. Now, that could warn you of something bad. That's very rare, but that's just something to keep in the background. So you reckon get the ultra-high version of the headphones and then have the earbuds, but then you're not getting the noise reduction as well. What you want is all three.
Yeah.
You want microphone plus noise reduction plus extra passive protection. I think it's a niche in the market.
Reese, have we got you on the path at least?
Yeah.
Yes, indeed. Well, there's actually a company who is producing something along these lines that was stating that the noise-cancelling headphones don't protect your hearing. So maybe I'll need to get a pair of them.
They will protect to some degree, but you've only got one set of ears, and I keep on telling all my nieces and nephews to get a good hi-fi system now, which you can do for under $1,000, because your ears are the best they'll ever be.
Mm.
Yeah.
Well,
so protect your hearing.
Reese, happy listening.
Thank you.
Do you listen? Is it Triple J that you're listening to in the headphones?
Yes, among lots of other things.
Okay.
Podcasts, good tunes, all of it.
Hell yeah, Reese. Thank you so much. Thank you for your support. We got Jazz in Gympie. Jazz, talk us through your question.
Hi, guys. I'm a refrigeration mechanic, and in TAFE, when I was at TAFE, our teacher was talking to us about how helium is used in MRI machines to keep it cold because they generate so much heat, and helium could run and obviously not freeze at like a really, really low temperature, but we're running out of helium, and he was like, you have to stop buying helium balloons, we're running out. So I was just wondering if that was true or...
Yeah. So what's the current slang word for refrigeration mechanic? Is it reefer or, sorry, friggy?
Friggy.
Oh, so
yeah.
You're still a friggy. So you.
I am still friggy.
Wow. So you're one of the very few people in our society who knows how a fridge actually works. For most people, it's a magic box. Electricity goes in 1.5 kilowatt hours a day, and then it makes cold. Okay. Firstly, with helium, it's the second most common element in the universe.
Right.
Most common is hydrogen, followed by helium. Yep. The universe is basically 90% hydrogen atoms, 10% helium atoms, and you and me and our carbon and our oxygen and our iron, mate, we're just rounding errors. We're like fractions of 0.001%. However, the helium is not available to us. The way we get helium is normally as a byproduct of extracting natural gas, otherwise known as methane, out of the ground, and similarities. It's a very important gas because it stays as a gas when you run it down to only a few degrees above zero. And the reason that that's important is we need that characteristic of super, super low temperatures for MRI machines. MRI machines have the same kind of diagnostic ability as a CAT scanner, but better. They do the 3D thing, but they're impervious to bone. They can look through your skull, whereas CAT scanners are blocked by the bone. And the thing about the MRI machines, they use up so much electricity that we have to have them superconducting. We have to have them at only a few degrees above zero, maybe 10, 20, 30 degrees above zero. If we try to run them, if they weren't superconducting, they'd need 1,000 times the power supply. They just chew up electricity like crazy. So helium is essential for MRI machines because it provides the cold temperature for them to be superconducting. And by the way, there's always heat given off as a byproduct when electricity goes through a wire, except when it goes superconducting. And then it's not as though they go to very low losses, they go to zero. It's the weirdest thing. You can get a bit of material, and if it's the right material, it'll be superconducting. You take it down to that temperature where it's superconducting, maybe 50 degrees above absolute zero, you put an electric current into it, and you walk out the door. And providing it's kept at that low temperature, that current will still be going at exactly the same level a week later, a decade later, a century later.
Wow.
So it's got zero resistance, which is a really weird concept. So the helium is essential to get us down to the low temperatures where superconducting works, where MRI machines can work.
Right. And are we running out of helium?
Yes, we are using it up in balloons.
Yeah, so I should feel guilty about buying helium balloons.
No, love and joy is an important part of life, and you're a small part of the problem, and it's part of the shaming. Like in 2004, the big fossil fuel company BP brought in the concept of carbon miles to make everybody feel guilty about a situation that they had created. So I would move gently away from it, enjoying the fun and reduce your usage over time. But feeling guilt is not a healthy emotion.
It's not unusual. Not
really. Great. No.
Enjoy what you have, but gradually move away from it.
Thanks
good
so
on you
much,
for being
guys.
A fridgie too.
Thanks, Jess.
Oh, thank you.
Yay.
Thanks so much.
Yay.
Take care.
We got Mads in Carlton here. Mads, what's going on with this pine cone?
Hi. Yeah, so my pine cone is a Norfolk pine cone that I've just had for like 10 years because, you know, aesthetically pleasing and, you know, it looks good. But after 10 years, it is still closing up just before it rains. And then after it's rained and it's sunny, it'll open back up again. And I'm just sort of wondering, how is it still functioning and sort of semi-alive?
Wow.
It's not so much alive, but responding to moisture in the air. And before the storm, you get a rise in moisture. And then that causes the moisture to be absorbed by the specific material in the little tiny, I don't know what you call them, leaves or bumpies, there are bumpies, in the pine cone. And so it expands and then it changes shape. And then when it dries out, it changes shape back to its original form. And it's not going to break over a period of time. Like the number of cycles you'd have to run it through before the material would undergo a break would be of the order of hundreds of thousands or tens of thousands. And you're probably only doing it maybe 20 times a year. So you've got a lot of life left in that pine cone. By the way, I do not know the exact lifespan or fatigue life of a pine cone module. Can somebody ring in on 0439 757 555? Did I do that?
Yay!
Oh, my God, I got it right. And let us know. So we're talking here about somebody who's called a material scientist.
How big is the pine cone, Mads?
It's probably about 15 more centimetres. Like, it's pretty big because it's a Norfolk pine, but...
Wow, the size of a dog's head?
Half a ruler.
Maybe like a chihuahua head.
Okay, right.
How cool. Thanks, Matt.
Oh, that's awesome. Wow. It works better than my barometer, so
yeah.
You've got a barometer?
Yeah.
What other measuring instruments do you have at home? Temperature gauge?
Correct.
All
a weather
over
nerd.
It.
Hurrah.
Thank you. James in Brunswick, you work in a dark room. What kind of work do you do and what is your question?
Hey, so I work in a photographic dark room doing dark room developing, so no red light or anything, just completely pitch black. And when I'm developing, I notice that if my eyes are open, I'm very spatially aware of what's in front of me, what's beside me, where things are, even without being able to see them. But when I close my eyes, then everything sort of, that all just goes out the window. I was wondering what might be, like what sort of reaction that might be.
Right. So firstly, you're working with this ancient material called photographic film.
Yeah.
Wow. Is that market increasing in the same way that vinyl records are increasing in popularity?
Yeah, exactly that.
Really? And what sort of films do you use? Is it colour or black and white?
Colour, black and white, and slide film.
Right. So if you're doing colour and you're doing high-speed black and white, I'm guessing the room has to be, in fact, totally black. Is that right?
Yeah, pitch black, zero light.
So now, dark adaptation takes about 10 minutes for the cones and another 35 minutes for the rods. So even after 45 minutes, is there any hint of light anywhere that you can see sneaking in?
You can sort of start to see little micro sort of pinpricks, but it's not like when you wake up in the middle of the night and you can sort of see, you know, cracks around the edges of the room or anything like that. It's, for the most part, it's completely pitch black.
Mm. Okay, and I'm kind of guessing from your voice that, like Ronald Reagan, you have a young voice, so you're probably under 30s or something?
It's very flattering, but I'm in my mid-30s.
Okay, right. So what happens is that you know where your upper arm is by proprioception, and we've done the experiment of putting your finger on your nose in the dark. And so at each of your joints, you're measuring the angle. You have the same thing for your legs, but proprioception goes in your legs sooner. And in your 50s and 60s, you begin to lose it. And so you can, if you're not looking at the world and you close your eyes, you can then fall over. But you're in that younger age bracket, so almost certainly not, that's not what's happening. But I'm guessing that the tiny amounts of light that are coming in are enough to anchor you in reality. However, there's a separate thing that happens where even if there is absolutely no light at all, if you're in a totally black environment, when you shut your eyes, your brain switches into a different mode where you rely entirely upon the proprioceptors in your legs. And so as people get older, they find it hard to balance with their eyes shut. So I'm guessing that the pinpricks of light, even though you don't consciously sense them, are enough to physically orient you. And you say that, so do you have a tendency to say to almost fall over if you shut your eyes in a dark room?
Not fall over, but it's basically like loading sort of racks directly in front of you. But
got them to anchor to. So you're touching things in front of you.
Yeah, but once you close your eyes, that sort of, yeah, it's like almost a bit unsure.
Okay, so one thing you can do is what they call the wide-based gait, where your feet, instead of being directly under your hips, you shove them out a bit further to the side. And if you hang around a pub at closing time, you'll notice a lot of people are walking with their legs further apart than if they were sober. So if you adopt that pose, it'll give you an extra degree of stability for free.
Oh, interesting.
Great. Yeah. Thanks, James.
That was another PLA, public life announcement, public service announcement.
Public life announcement. I love that. Sophie in Geelong, you heard Dr. Carl earlier talking about peptides. What question do you have?
Yeah, hey guys. So I am really curious about the dangers of nowadays with social media and the beauty standards being set in, you know, with Instagram and everything. I'm seeing a lot of influencers sort of posting that they're on peptides and, you know, advocating for them. And they're also posting Instagram accounts that are sort of on the black market of where to purchase these peptides. So I'm wondering, where are these peptides coming from and what are they potentially going to be doing to the body just at the cost of being more tanned and skinny?
The peptides can be normally coming from overseas, we'll say China and other countries like that, where they've got massive chemical production available. But really, you can make them at home. They're just amino acids. So your body uses 20 different types of amino acids. And so if you're looking at a peptide chain of 10 amino acids, you've got 20 possibilities in the first amino acid, 20 in the second and so forth, and you end up with a number bigger than the number of stars in the Milky Way. So you can make peptides. So you can go and find a peptide which is, you know, according to some studies, fairly good at perhaps, say, increasing muscle mass. Now, first thing, it has side effects. Secondly, the purity is really hard. It's easy to make a chemical and a whole bunch of other stuff by accident. But to have only that chemical is just a whole different ballpark, which is why medical certified drugs, that's part of the reason of their expense, that they're guaranteed that when it says you're going to get 10 milligrams of this, that's what you're getting. You're not getting 5, you're not getting 50, and also there's no other things there. So I'd really steer clear of them because there's just so many bad side effects coming down the line. And also the studies upon which they're based to give you a tan, muscle strength, etc., in general fairly poor. I'm sorry.
Yeah, it's really scary though with social media now that it's actually being pushed for sale on somewhat of the black market, you know.
We can all get fooled at least once. I have been fooled at least once, maybe once every couple of years now. If somebody new comes up to you and they sound convincing, you can be fooled. Everybody can be fooled at least once.
Yeah.
You don't want to get fooled that second time. But with the peptides, I'd definitely steer away from them unless 100%. You're doing it under medical supervision where you're getting medical-grade peptides.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Thanks, Sophie.
Yeah, definitely. Thanks, guys.
Appreciate your question. And that's all we've got time for. On Science with Dr. Carly, you can check out this full episode wherever you get your podcasts, whether that's YouTube, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, we're there. Dr. Carl, I'll catch you again next week.
Peachy keen.
And that's it. Thank you so much for listening to this week's episode of Science with Dr. Carl. And if you have a question for the big man and you cannot hold on to it any longer, we've got a place just for you to submit it. If you scroll to your show notes, there's a Google form. You just have to fill out your name, where you're from, your best contact number, and what your question is for Dr. Carl. Make sure you stay by your phone because we want to get you on the radio to ask the question yourself. Fill it out, send it to us, and you could be in an upcoming episode of Science with Dr. Carl. This one was produced by Josh Brennan. I'm Lucy Smith. We'll catch you next week. Bye.
Dave Marchese here from the Triple J Hack team. Hey, if you love Dr. Carl's podcast like I do, you might enjoy the Hack podcast as well. Each day, we bring you the news that matters to you, from the latest science on climate change to what's happening in politics and news around the world. The Hack podcast, it's your daily fix of the news you need to know. Get it wherever you're listening now.